Hello, everyone. I'm Robbie Dorman, and this is A Serial Fanaticist, the podcast for fans of everything. Welcome. Today, I am joined by Matt Hamm to talk about The Fellowship of the Ring, Part 1 of the Lord of the Rings trilogy by J.R.R. Tolkien. We talk about the origins of modern fantasy, compare the book to the film, and how they are now impossibly connected, and discuss Tom Bombadil. Neither of us had read the book in a very long time, so it was a joy to re-experience it with Matt. There are spoilers contained within, so beware if you are somehow unaware of Lord of the Rings. It was a great chat. On to the discussion! I'm here with my Simpsons show co-host once again, Matt Hamm. Matt, how are you?
I'm good. I got my furry feet on and my, you know, dictionary of Middle Earth terms.
Oh, do you have
There's only like 300,000 names in this book alone.
There's not 300,000.
Okay, but there might be at least 300 random names for things.
I know.
Oh yeah, it's Isengard, but the tower is Orthanc, and we need to know that.
We are discussing the first book of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, Fellowship of the Ring, consisting of the first two books of the Lord of the Rings. There's a weird history that apparently I've read all about this. That's very exciting about how, why this book is formatted
there's,
the way it
six
is.
Six books, but they're usually collected in three volumes and blah, 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 blah.
Yep. Apparently publishing in the 50s in Britain was extraordinarily expensive and they did not want to publish everything in one giant book. So they split it up into three
books.
Which
is fine. I mean, that works. They're three, you know, decently length novels. I mean, I think the version of The Fellowship that I read was like 594 pages, and that's probably as long as a single book should be, unless you're the guy who wrote Jerusalem, blanking on the name.
Alan Moore,
that's the one. Unless you're crazy like Neal Stephenson, you don't need books that long.
Or Tolstoy, another
also
long, yes. long book writer, wrote epics. I've read these books as a teenager, which at this point as probably when I was 14, which is that is nearly 20 years ago, which I'm starting to feel old, Matt, because I know I've read these books before and I'm like, I don't remember much. And then I read it and instantly I'm like, oh yeah, right, all this stuff immediately.
Oh, they're sleeping in the forest again. Hey, look, they went on a tree.
Sometimes they sleep on trees, Matt.
That's true. There's a reason it sounded familiar, because you read it three pages ago.
That's not fair, Matt. Have you read this before?
I read Fellowship once before, back right when the movies came out.
But you haven't gone past Fellowship?
No, I have not actually read Two Towers, so it'll be interesting to find the fun differences. Hopefully there are more, like the whole excising of Tom Bombadil. Like, oh, they just left this entire part out. That's cool.
I wonder. Oh, right. Yeah, those movies are so ingrained in my mind, because I really try to imagine these characters as anyone else besides the people in the movie. I really, really tried. I could not, for the most part.
No, because they are so iconic. I mean, even when they describe the hobbits, you're just fitting them in like little puzzle pieces into how the actual actors looked.
And I think largely it's that. It's because the casting was so good and that Peter Jackson did such a good job with picking those actors that suit these roles. And when they mention Frodo, I'm thinking of what's his
Elijah
face?
Wood.
Elijah Wood. I'm thinking of Sam. I'm thinking of Sam. I'm thinking of Sean Astin. I'm thinking of Viggo.
Viggo Mortensen. The only one that I noticed whose description is really off is Boromir. Sean Bean is great as Boromir, and that's totally okay, but in the book they constantly describe him as like a foot shorter than Aragorn and like really wide, and it's like, oh no, Sean Bean is pretty much, if you gave him a wig and turned him around, him and Viggo Mortensen are the same guy.
They're men, they're all the same, Matt, what are you talking about?
That's true.
They're all, who cares? You don't need to know
we
the difference.
We men are completely interchangeable.
All men, all humans in Middle Earth are basically the same person, it seems.
That's true.
The elves get to be like each little unique special snowflakes. Hobbits are special because they're not. Dwarves are these little tiny mountains of men, and men are just kind of generic hero dude.
They're the default, basically. It's like, here, we started from this, and then we made the minor changes, and that's everyone else.
Did you enjoy your time with this book, Matt?
I did. I really did. Okay, I constantly complain about how long this book is, and it's a bit much to call it a novel. I would more call it a travelogue, because he describes every little thing that they do. It's not they just, we walked through the forest. It's, we went down past this one tree. You know that one guy's farm? We went around his farm and then cut through. And then there was this big troll statue. Remember that big troll statue? It's like you're talking to somebody you went to high school with and describing a trip you took to them. And thankfully, there are maps. There's actually a really good one at lotrproject.com. If you do read this book along with us, that's really well done. It's very interactive. And I actually had that up for a large portion of my reading just so I could figure out what he was talking about, because I understand that when you write a novel, especially, you want to describe what the environment is like. But rather than describe it directly, a lot of the times he just kind of describes where they are and expects you to get it. Like, there are other times when he describes things perfectly well, like, oh, we're in a forest. This tree is, you know, got a great trunk, and it's got this weird platform in the middle that has to have a special name, because, of course, everything has to have a special name. But beyond little things like that, it's a really well-written book. The characters are very interesting. I don't know why there is so much attention paid to the minutiae of their lives, of like, oh, we slept like this and we cooked this for breakfast kind of thing. But I guess it's just the way he wanted to do it. But if you just kind of get past those parts, there's a lot of really good action. The characters are very interesting. There's actually, I was talking to my wife, there's a really interesting analog about growing up in Just Fellowship, and I'm sure it continues on into the other books, but we can probably get into that later.
There's a lot of description, a lot of world building, as that if I were going to put it generously, there's a lot of world building in the journey, in this road trip. But
yes, a road trip. That is a good phrase for it.
It is all one. It falls into tedium at times. The Tom Bombadil stuff. That was the rough part. Everything else is fine. Everything else I was fine with the descriptions. But when they're just wandering through a scary forest and Tom Bombadil is suddenly there, and then there's these whites and I understand immediately why it's cut from the movies, because it serves literally no purpose. It's just it is another hardship that the hobbits have to go through. But that part was the hardest part. But luckily, it's not incredibly long. It is a few chapters, and then you're out of the realm of Tom Bombadil, and even. It feels like Gandalf himself is just like, when they bring up Tom Bombadil, can he help us? And Gandalf's like, no, he can't help us. No, let's not talk about him.
It's like, no, he doesn't leave his house. He's a creepy hermit.
He's a weirdo. Yeah, he's old and powerful. Also incredibly strange. We don't mess around with him too much.
Well, the funny thing is, with the whole Tom Bombadil thing, at that point in the book, they have already been chased by the Black Riders. They were chased into the forest by the Black Riders. So they're trying to avoid them. And so they go into Tom Bombadil's little forest area, and there's something weird, and then a tree tries to kidnap them, and Tom Bombadil comes to save them. It's like you raise the stakes, and then you take a side trip rather than continuing to raise them. It's a very weird
side trip. And that is not necessarily... I think that's emblematic of, I think, frankly, all of the books, from my recollection, and definitely this one, having just read it, in that it has these alternating periods of rising tension, and then not necessarily, like, a conclusion of it. It's more of just a postponement. That they reach sanctuary, a temporary sanctuary, and in this book, it's usually where elves are. Everything's okay. We are with the elves. They'll protect us for now.
Yeah. which I'm pretty sure goes away in the later books. Like, oh, we're with some dwarves now. We're with some men. Oh, it's not protection. There's weird crap going on. But with the elves, you're okay.
Yeah.
They're in charge.
And I think that's... I think that the elves are really... I think it's effective how the elves are described, because I even knowing myself, knowing I'm tired of these elves. Yes, they're pretty. Yes, they glow and they're special and perfect and they don't age and they're immortal and they're beautiful
and they're fast and they're quiet. And basically there's a reason their places are, you know, where everyone is safe, is because they can do anything and barely have to try. Look what every other race is working with. You got the dwarves who are kind of greedy and short, and you got men who for some reason are just jerks to everyone. It's like there's a reason the elves were in charge and are leaving, because basically the elves tried to gentrify the neighborhood and said, you know what, we're giving up, we're going somewhere else.
Yeah, that's the arc of this book, is like you get the hobbits, you get them trekking as friends through and being followed by the Nazgul, and trying to find help, trying to find Gandalf, trying to get to Rivendell, and they eventually get there. And that serves as basically the halfway point. And then the Fellowship is joined, and then the Fellowship dissolves after Gandalf dies, and Boromir is driven a little bit crazy by the ring.
That's actually one of the things. Okay, so immediately after finishing this book, I went and watched the movie because I had, you know, better memories of the movies than of the books. And I watched the extended edition, which is about 4 hours. And it's actually only ends up being about 3 hours and 10 minutes, because there's 40 minutes of credits. And this is one of the few instances, with the exception of Boromir's character, where I completely agree with every single change they made to the book, because they completely excised all like the weird random stuff that happens, and like them staying. I think in the book it says they stayed in Lothlorien for a month, and then they stayed in Rivendell for a month. And it's like, guys, why would you stay there for that long when it's really important this ring get destroyed? It's just crazy. But the character of Boromir, I feel like he's given a decent amount of attention in the movie, but they seem to play him up as much more vulnerable to the influence of the ring, kind of thing. And there's a lot of instances where he's being a jerk, whereas in the book, Boromir seems like a really solid stand-up guy. Like he's working really hard to make sure this whole Fellowship thing succeeds. And until, when they're at on the west bank of the river, when they all split up, he's got it pretty much under control, and then he just dies. It's like, oh, I wanted to see him, like, you know, be a good person some more, rather than just be a jerk once, and then all of a sudden he's dead.
I mean, I think, well, they hint at it a couple times for him to, like, having a little bit of self-serving interest with the ring. Like, at when in the meeting of the joining of the Fellowship in Rivendell, a brief, very, very brief moment of him maybe questioning, hey, what if we just use the ring? And Elrond's right there like, no, that doesn't, you can't, it's impossible, because the ring will turn you to evil. And then you get it again much later after Lothlorien, I think, where he brings it up to the group and it's quickly shot down or something like that. And then he goes off after Frodo, and I don't think Boromir is anything more to Tolkien than as a demonstration of the ring's power. It's like how it can seduce, and how men are more susceptible than anyone, because men are weak.
Well, yeah, and then for some reason the elves are not that vulnerable, and hobbits just straight up aren't. Except for Bilbo being a little weird after 100 years of the Dameron.
I know, he did have it for a very long time. So it's not, he actually, all it took was like Gandalf going, hey man, give it up.
And it's like, hey, stop being a douche.
Stop. And Bilbo was like, okay, all right. Like even when Frodo came back, when they met up in, was it Rivendell that broke? Yeah, they were in Rivendell, they were both there. They were not, yeah. I'm trying to remember where Bilbo was, but Bilbo's like, can I see it? And then even then he's just like, and then Frodo's like, no, I should, it's my burden. And Frodo's like, yeah, and Bilbo's like, yeah, you're right. It's my time's over. I'm old now.
So just hang out there and write your book, man.
Mm-hmm. I, so I don't, you know, like, Boromir honestly isn't given a lot of time in this book. He is just a soldier. You know, he's not special. He's not like, he's not a exiled king. He's not Strider. He is not an elf or a dwarf. He is not any of the four hobbits. He is just a dude that just...
Well, to be fair, he is the son of the steward of Gondor. So the guy who's basically running Gondor right now, he's his son. So he's a little more important than a random soldier. But yeah, compared to those people, he's like nothing.
Yeah. And, I mean, he doesn't get... Like, Strider... And slash Aragorn, when they meet him, it's like he's this mysterious dude in a tavern, and he saves their lives multiple times. He is like bold and like, and that's the other thing, like that I think that does differ from how he's portrayed in the movie, is that he's not as much. He's like, he seems like a very like yelly, bold guy in the book. In the movie, he seems closer to...
He seems confront... I don't know if I'd call him yelly, but I would definitely call him more confrontational. Like, when he first meets with the four hobbits, he's very much like, I'm not going to tell you anything about me, but I'm going to yell at you about stuff you're doing. And it's like, dude, you got to tell people who you are, otherwise they're not going to listen to you.
He's like, come on, look at me, man. I'm a ranger. I'm
like,
awesome.
Yeah, I'm cool. I'm all greasy and wearing black.
I'm awesome.
Doesn't make you want to trust me?
Look, I have this broken sword.
Which is funny, because, yeah, in the book... He just carries around the broken sword with him, but in the movie, he has a full sword with him, and the broken sword just is kept back at Rivendell.
Probably because they were like, no, he would be a ranger, he'd have to have a real sword, because he'd fight
people. Which is probably a good point.
I mean, I think most times rangers don't fight, they just hide. You know, they sneak around.
That's true.
But, back to my original thing. I started something about 15 minutes ago. Despite all that tedium, this just being... I'll say everything except for Tom Bombadil is kind of joyous. It's just really enjoyable. It's pleasant to read. It's pleasant. It just feels like a warm blanket.
Yeah, it's I don't know if I would call it a warm blanket, but there is not that much peril. I mean, there is, but it's a manageable amount. It's not like the world is coming to an end. It's, oh man, these guys are going to catch you kind of thing. And it's always broken up really quickly. There are never moments like that that last very long. They'll find, oh, look, they're on their way out of the Shire. And there's these random elves that they hang out with for a little while. And, the Dark Riders are after them. And then they'll find Tom Bombadil. And, oh no, they're stuck in a barrow den. And, oh, Tom Bombadil came to save them. And, oh, you know, they finally got to Strider, and they, you know, left town just in time to beat the Riders, and, oh, look, now there's Glorfindel, and he's going to heal Frodo and take him to Rivendell. It's like, there's bad stuff that happens, especially in book one, the first half of Fellowship. You know, bad things don't stick to them. They hit them and then just kind of slide off. And more so in book two does the bad stuff kind of stick, especially when Gandalf is killed and, you know, the Mines of Moria and whatnot.
Yeah, and I don't necessarily mean pleasant as in like, oh, everything's happy and joyous and we're all having a good time, you know, fighting orcs in the dark and Nazgul chasing Frodo. It's more that in this world, that in this epic high fantasy, there is good and there is evil and things are simple. To a certain extent, and you have Frodo and you have this ring, and it's really, I think largely it's rooted in a simple thing of the hobbits. It is rooted in that despite all these crazy characters, despite the elf and the dwarf, the elves and the dwarf, and Gandalf, this powerful wizard, and Strider, this deposed I don't know what adjective necessarily to call him. He's a king, not that it's not a king. But all these characters who have immense power, immense knowledge, and then it's about hobbits. It's about these little folk who are simple, and all they like eating, and they like eating and drinking and singing, and are largely pure. And I think that is what I keep coming back to, is just like, it's nice to have Frodo as like, he does a lot of work in the very beginning of the book to talk about how Frodo is the best And Frodo is great. And Frodo's the best of the hobbits.
Well, and that he's a very simple guy, basically, is what he gets down to.
And in counterpart to Frodo, you have the ring. They still don't have necessarily a concrete grasp of what the ring actually is. I think it is intentionally so. I think it is, hey, this ring is the keeper of all the rings, of all these rings of power, and you can't let Sauron have it again, and you can't give into its power, and you can't let anyone have it or anyone wear it, and intentionally so, that this kind of symbol of ultimate corruption is given to this purest little guy, this little nice boy. He's 50.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I thought was really funny about the book, because I remember the movie. In the movie, it seems like, oh, Frodo went home that night, and like the next day, Gandalf showed up and said, you got to leave. But no, in the book, it's 17 years after Bilbo leaves before they have to leave.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, that's just distillation of you know, making movies snappy. It's not.
Oh, yeah.
Tolkien is not always, he's largely very, like, despite the fact that, oh yeah, everything needs to, we need to move very quickly, the ring needs to get, we need to destroy the ring, we need to do it, he's largely unconcerned with matters of time. You know, in I think because the scope of his vision of this world is so large and so expanded, that Frodo taking only 17 years is nothing. 17 years is not any amount of time.
No, especially since apparently your 11-D-1st birthday, aka 111, is just, oh, that's another birthday we celebrate. You know, it's cool and all, but it's, you know, whatever.
It's you're getting up there, but you're not near the end of your life. You guess I got plenty of time. Bilbo, especially, well, Bilbo wasn't really aging, because I imagine,
yeah, because of the ring.
Yeah. But that's the other thing that I don't know. We talk about the story and all this, and it's at the same time as I'm enjoying this journey of the ring, and it's kind of very familiar. Like, after, you know, because I've seen the movies so many times, and because it's kind of this pattern that these books follow in is so familiar. The whole time I'm thinking about how crazy this is, how these books, the story, is the foundation of, like, all fantasy, all modern fantasy for the most part.
All high fantasy, especially.
I mean, even low fantasy is not a, like, don't.
Well,
like,
before this, though, you had something like Conan, which is more of a low fantasy of just, it's basically the Middle Ages with a little bit of magic world. And this is more along the lines of, like, oh, there's all these crazy races and, like, I'm sure there were elves before Tolkien and dwarves, but I feel like this is where they were crystallized into what everyone today seems to think they are.
There were, I mean, elves and dwarves were like folklore from the Middle Ages. That's what, and they were like, you know, Nordic and Germanic traditions and fairy tales. I think it's been codified now, because we think, like, you think of Warhammer and you think of Warcraft and you think of even Game of Thrones to a certain extent, like all modern fantasy. You think of, you know what an orc is, you know what an elf is, you know what a dwarf is. You know these things. And they didn't exist. This was published in 1954. Before 1954, no one knew, hobbits didn't exist. And elves and dwarves were things like in Nordic stories that you would maybe read if you were a nerd. Like Tolkien.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Is like, before this, no one really paid attention to those kind of things. Like, no one knew really what they were.
And in those intervening, like, 60 odd years, it is everything. That it is, like, if you engage with any kind of fantasy, and this, like, there's no one else who has done this. No one, I think, like, impacting pop culture, I can't think of another one singular person who is responsible for more than Tolkien is.
Yeah, I really can't either, because I mean this is something he essentially just, it's very akin to I want to say what like Marvel did with the Norse gods and the Thor comics in like the 50s and 60s. They just took something that existed before and they just completely, you know, rechristened it into something not entirely new, but for the most part, unlike previous visions of them. And obviously Tolkien did it to a greater degree because, quite frankly, these races are nothing like what we thought they were. And this story, like this entire world that he created, I mean, he created languages, several languages just for this. I mean, that's kind of what the guy did, but it's crazy how much work he put into it and how we're still using a lot of it today. There are people who can speak Elvish.
Yeah, it's I would say, secondary to Klingon as...
Yeah.
Most popular fictional language, maybe Dothraki is getting up there now with Game of Thrones being so popular. But he actually, Tolkien was a big nerd. He loved language. He loved folklore. He did his own translation of Beowulf that eventually was published by his son. He took all of those disparate folk ideas from folklore and codify them into this book, and then the various other, I don't know what to call them, collections of lore surrounding the Middle Earth and all that. So I don't know. It staggers me kind of because it is. I don't think he ever understood. You know, he died in the 80s. I don't think it was probably already the effects were already being seen then. But like, read a fantasy novel now, read any fantasy novel,
and that's it.
There are people who depart from it, but it's kind of hard to, if you're writing fantasy, you're willingly engaging in a genre that was largely created by Tolkien. There are certainly fantasy like novels before Tolkien, but he defined and created the genre of like George R. R. Martin is largely like he's redefined fantasy, but it's because he's redefining it by tweaking the tropes that we expect from Tolkien.
Right.
He follows and largely like having reading this after reading. Oh, the Saga of Ice and Fire novels, you can see the blueprints. You can see the direct, like, I think George R. R. Martin is a better writer of character than Tolkien is, at least nuanced characters in the way, you know, in this grim world that that Westeros is. But I feel like I play a video game and I go dwarves and I think of Dungeons and Dragons and I think of dwarves and I think of like all these dwarves and like this dwarf is just what Tolkien assigned to them. We still haven't veered off too far from them. Like they have beards and they love drinking and they like gold.
Well, one of the funny things I think is really interesting is the idea of fantasy taking place in a medieval setting. That is something that has stuck so hard that it took until probably, I feel like even the 90s or early 2000s when people finally started branching off from that. Like, I'm sure, I'm sure there was somebody who was doing something like that earlier who was saying, hey, maybe we can have like a fantasy setting in some other time. Like, oh, let's take it to other parts of the world or other times. Like, hey, maybe there was magic in the Old West, or how about we put some orcs in like the Napoleonic Wars kind of thing. But for some reason, when people saw what Tolkien did with taking magic and elves and orcs and hobbits and dwarves and all that and saying it's going to be a medieval type setting, people have really stuck with that. And I don't quite know why, but it's definitely something that has stuck around.
Yeah, I mean, steampunk became a thing at some point, but I don't know what the first steampunk novel was, which is a sort of melding of fantasy and noir and cyberpunk, and I don't know, after a certain point all those genres start getting mixed into just, hey, it's urban fantasy again. But again, even that is still, I think, something back to Tolkien, and that is just, it's hard to get wrapped your mind around, because that's not that long ago. These traditions that feel so ingrained in our culture are not that old. They're, you know, that they're younger than my parents. And
wow. That's crazy to think about.
Yeah, like this stuff didn't exist when my parents were born, a few years before this book came out. So that's the, I don't know, it my and the like it just this it, it this book gives me the warm and fuzzies, and it's not it certainly there's bad stuff that happens in it. It's just like it's a nice hit of nostalgia because my grandmother loved them. She named her cat Shadowfax.
Aww.
All white cat named Shadowfax. It was a very nice cat, very cute. And I don't know. It just feels nice to go into this world where I like Frodo. I like Sam. I like Merry and Pippin. I like Gandalf and Aragorn. These characters are so, they fit so lovely into these little, like you're talking about like like niches. They just fill these little spots and they're just perfect.
Well, yeah, because all of the characters are somehow not the same, but they're all a little roguish, except kind of Frodo. They're all just a little bit roguish, but they're still good people. And this is one of those cases of it feels more like a co-op game. Like you are working with your friends toward achieving this one thing. It's not something where all these people are competing against each other to, you know, win some prize or something. It's very much, these are all good people. They're all working together. They're all different in lots of different ways, but you still really want them to succeed.
Yes, I highlighted, take such friends as are trusty and willing. And like, even when at the very end of this book, where Frodo sees Boromir get seduced by the ring and has to run from him, even Frodo's decision to, no, I need to go alone, is driven by him wanting to protect the others, both from the danger that the ring invites and the danger of them being seduced by the ring and falling into darkness and like end up having to betray him. He doesn't want that at risk. And that in and of itself speaks to the fact that he can't deny Sam. When Sam finds him and goes off with him, he can't deny Sam because Sam is his true friend, his true companion.
Well, yeah, because Sam is the one who is going to stick by him through thick and thin, no matter what.
Yeah, Sam, true hero of Lord of the Rings.
Really, when you look at the whole trilogy, yeah, Sam's the only reason they succeeded. If it wasn't for Sam, they would all be screwed.
And like, they're all kind of badasses, and they all get their moments of being awesome in combat and out of combat. Like that moment I always forget about, it is the moment with Gimli and was it Galadriel, when
he asked for her hair.
Yeah, it's just so sweet. It's just so sweet. Like Galadriel says something nice about dwarves and Gimli's little cold iron heart is cracked open, and he's like, all I want is your hair. And I'm going to make a monument out of it because you're like an angel.
Well, I mean, he's not wrong. She's ultimately powerful and can squash him in any way she wants.
True, because she wears one of the rings, one of the elf rings.
Even though she doesn't like to tell people that. She's like, oh, yeah, I'm just totally powerful. Wink.
She tells Frodo, and he's the one who starts spilling his gums out in the world where anyone can be listening, Frodo.
He's totally willing to just give it away all the time. Like, oh, here you go. Oh, here you go. Oh, you want the ring? Sure, go take it. You want this ring? All right, go take it. It's like, Frodo, buddy, come on, man. Stop trying to give the ring away.
I don't think, I think he is starting to understand. He doesn't quite understand. I think that moment with Boromir is kind of because that is the first time that someone demands it from him and is willing to take it. One of the yeah, good guys. True. One of the good guys is willing to take it from him. Other times, it's to people he respects. He is like, well, if you're better to take it, then you should. And you are the right person to carry it. And you bear it. And Boromir is the first time when a good person, quote unquote, someone that I think Frodo respects Boromir to a certain extent, he's helped him out a lot. Boromir is like, hey, I should use that. I can use that to reclaim this kingdom under the power of man. And we can rule. And Frodo's like, no, you can't.
He's like, look, you seem like a nice enough guy, but nah, you would very obviously fall under the dark powers of this ring. Like, if you gave it to Galadriel, sure, things would probably be okay. But if you gave it to Boromir, he's obviously way too under the influence of it already.
I would not get that ring to Galadriel. That'd be
terrifying.
You'd have a terrible, terrible queen.
Lawful good. Like, super lawful.
Absolute power corrupts, man. Absolute. And power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts. Absolutely. And also, just the... Speaking of kind of cliche idioms, so many in this book. So many sayings that have...
just taken over our society.
Made their way into our everyday speech. Not All Who Wander Are Lost is my particular favorite, because it is the one that you see on, like, motivational posters and stuff, but it's actually about how everyone in the world is out to get you, so be careful. Everyone is hiding under all that glitters is not gold, and not all who wander are lost. Like, be careful. The Dark Riders are not just, you know, wandering riders. They're Nazgul out to get you.
Yeah. And they will certainly try.
Yeah. I love the Nazgul. It's such a cool concept. Such a good, like, corrupted kings of old elder day kings of man who wore the rings and are now immaterial ghouls riding down Frodo. So cool. There's no depth to anything, like I'm saying. It's just, that's a cool thing. I can't help it. That's the other thing. It's just like, this is just, there's other people who've written.
It's really well thought out.
Yeah, there's other people who've written great fantasy since, obviously. But you go back to the beginning and it still works. You know, like, if you read, I don't know, I think the only comparable point I have would be like, Modern Prometheus Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, when she basically created horror. Like, Frankenstein still holds up. I still think that book is good. And it's like, but you read a lot of horror in the meantime, and, like, I don't know, her and Tolkien, they're in a very exclusive club. They created modern genre fiction. And that's a other thing that it's a thing that I wanted to bring up. Because it is a thing that I have heard about in the meantime about these books and about this world, and something I never realized when I read before, and it's probably just because I was young and didn't know what I was, you know, I didn't see that the signs. But this is basically, it is a world in decline. It is a dying world. It's an entropic world. This Middle Earth is fading. The best days of Middle Earth are behind it.
Well, that's kind of one of the themes of the entire trilogy, and we'll probably get back to that more when we do Return of the Kings, is that at this point in Fellowship, you're right, it is an entropic world, things are going downhill all over the place. They keep mentioning over and over again, oh yeah, some people used to live here, but now it's empty, no one lives there now, and, you know, the dwarves been kicked out of Moria for their greed and delving too deep and releasing a demon and that sort of thing. And that's supposedly one of the things that this quest to rid Middle Earth of the darkness, quote unquote, is meant to, you know, rejuvenate it so that that does not happen. Like, oh, we can now usher in the age of men because, you know, once this darkness is taken from them, the only, like, major, you know, culture of humans is not constantly fighting with Mordor, maybe they can get around to doing some good stuff.
It's just emphasized over and over and over again. And, like, this is Gloin, and when he's talking about the joining of the Fellowship. We have done well, but in metalwork we cannot rival our fathers, many of whose secrets are lost. Like,
that's just weird.
there's in Lothlorien, who says this? I think this is Haldir, who says, yet I do not believe that the world about us will ever again be as if it was of old, or the light of the sun as it was aforetime.
It's such a defeatist attitude that I feel like a lot of people even today still have.
Yeah. And I think it's a world in decline has become a trope of fantasy. Like, it's another thing that a lot of fantasy fiction has. I can think of multiple series that I've read where they take place in a world that is fading. you know, a world that is in decline. And these the heroes, the protagonists are trying to not necessarily like even like bring the world back to its prime. It is just forestalling the inevitable, just to hold off, hold off that entropy for a little while. And that's and like I don't get like I don't think anyone is thinking that this ring is destroying the ring is necessarily going to bring back the light, you know, bring back the golden age or whatever, but because the elves are gone, they are like they that moment that meeting with Galadriel where he offers her the ring and she declines, you know, because she's a good person, and she's like, there are two results to you destroying the, you know, there's either the ring is stays whole and we remain in Middle Earth with some power until we are taken over by Mordor, which will happen, or you destroy the ring and we leave anyway, because we are in decline, because without the ring's power, we cannot stay. We have to leave. We have to go over the Western Ocean, isn't it? What is it? Whatever it is.
Yeah, from the Grey Haven, they launch westward to, I think, Valinor is what Aragorn calls it.
Which, yeah, all those names, Matt, you referred to, the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of names. Yeah. I frankly don't mind them. I don't mind them. That is the one thing that feels a little bit dated in this book, because it is just like, oh man, most modern fantasy, at least most modern good fantasy, hides its info dumps a little bit better.
Yeah, usually it's like one person telling someone else a few things here and there, rather than, all right, we're going to have this long speech about the way things used to be and why they're better than they are now.
Or about all these places and who rules them and all that. Like, I think that's the only thing but to be fair, it is like the first time he's creating a thing in front of us. So I will cut him some slack. And in for every case that I'm going like, okay, I get it. Yeah, this elf land used to be really great, and now it's not. You know, describing the depths of Moria and the dwarf lore and this fallen kingdom below the mountain. Give me it all. I'll just nom 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 nom. Give it to me. I want all of it. I want to know what happened to these dwarf lords. I want to know what killed them. I need to know about the Balrog, and I want to know all this stuff. Give me it. Can't get enough. Going down into dark tunnels underneath the mountain. I'll take it all day long. You didn't like it, Matt? Oh, so it's my favorite.
No, I was totally down for it. I thought it was great. Like, a lot of this stuff is just really easy to, you know, pick up quickly. And that's not always the case, but a lot of the time it is.
Yeah, here is Galadriel. For if you fail, then we are laid bare to the enemy. Yet if you succeed, then our power is diminished and Lothlorien will fade. And the tides of time will sweep it away. We must depart into the west, or dwindle to a rustic folk of dell and cave, slowly to forget and to be forgotten. And like these mythic, beautiful elves are fading, are gone, and the world's going to be left without them. You know, even if Frodo succeeds, I feel like that is Tolkien himself, like saying like. It, you know, he was a opponent of modernization. He didn't like technology. He rode a bicycle whenever he could. And I feel like the elves are kind of that pure remnant. The elves and magic are kind of this pure remnant of a simple world, of a world where anything could happen. And it, regardless of what happens, that stuff's going to be driven and driven away and fade. And we're going to be left in a plainer, less special world with men, even if it turns out right, even if they destroy the ring and Aragorn returns as a king, which we know that happens. But this kind of fading of this magic is sorrowful and sad, even with success. And like there's. this that kind of sad undertone of this journey of the, I don't know, there is a depth to this quest versus it's not a simple, oh, you return the ring, you destroy it, and we win. Even if you win, we're still going to lose things. Things are going to be gone. And that stuff is what separates this from the things that came before it. It's what separates it from the fairy tales and the folklore and the Conans of the world. And that kind of fantasy that existed prior. It adds the myths and legends and sorrowness of folklore, and transcends just, hey, there's a prince and he kills a dragon, which is what you know, and that's what the Hobbit is, you know, that's what the Hobbit was before this. Hobbit came out before this, and they wanted a sequel, and Tolkien did was go, oh, well, I'll just create an entire world and make it complex and interesting. And it's like,
hey, the world of the Hobbit, yeah, it's more ideas for that place. Here's 10,000 pages.
It's a lot. This is not even, despite how long The Lord of the Rings is, it is not, there's still so much more in the Silmarillion and all the other associated lore books that have been published since his death, which I have not read any of, because the lore itself is not what's fascinating to me. It's how it affects these characters.
Right. It's the story is what it comes down to, and how it affects, you know, what's happening.
Right. It's when Gimli goes down into Moria, sees this dead city that his people built, and is distraught. That is what I'm interested in. The dead city itself is fascinating, but without Gimli's reaction to it, it doesn't mean much. It is Gandalf's reaction to seeing a Balrog. It is Frodo's conversation with Galadriel about giving her the ring, and her saying, I could take it, but then you would have a terrible queen instead of Sauron, and it would be no better. It's those interactions and the implications of all this lore and all this history. You know, it is Elrond talking about all this history, and I'm like, oh, and it doesn't really matter. Like, all this stuff, nothing, it doesn't change anything about the ring.
Nope, the ring is bad, just the way it is.
I also thought about those video games. Shadow Mordor and Shadow... why can't I think of the name now, Matt? The one game before this one.
I don't know.
It's the Shadow of War, and then the one before that was...
That was just Shadow of Mordor.
Was it Shadow of Mordor was the first one? That's what I'm trying to remember.
I thought so.
Yeah, Shadow of Mordor was the first one, and Shadow of War is the second one, of Celebrimbor, the guy who made the rings. Which, that's... After reading those games, make zero sense whatsoever. They're fun to play, but they don't make any sense in context of the books. I think that's why a lot of Lord of the Ring people were very upset at those video games, because they break the canon of things. But who cares?
It's like, hey, there's this random dude running around, and he's getting orcs to follow him. It's weird.
It doesn't make any sense. You'd think they'd mention that at least once in the books. Yeah. You know? Also, the idea. The Shire is just a lovely place.
The Shire sounds like the English countryside. I think that's kind of what he was getting at. It's like, oh, yeah, this is where all the happy people are. It's away from the cities. They're just living in their little hobbit holes under the ground, doing nothing but eating and talking to one another.
And having parties and farming. Nice, simple lives. They don't get in with that magic. They think it's crazy. They don't get in with the big people. Those big people, they bring in problems. We're simple people. We're little people. We're good. We're halflings. Everything's good with us. Gollum.
Thankfully, he's not in this much.
He's not. He's just kind of like a weird, creepy thing that follows him around for a while. He's not a character, really. He is a boogeyman.
Yeah, I thought it was really funny when, you know, Frodo keeps noticing these two eyes, and he eventually brings it up to Aragorn, and Aragorn's like, oh yeah, that's Gollum. He's been following us forever. You know, I was hoping he'd just go away.
Yeah, I tried to catch him. He's slippery. He's a sneaky fella. in apparently the wiki also lists Gandalf's age as primeval.
Well, I mean, he was created with, you know, the beginning of the world, so.
And Legolas is over 500 years old. Gimli is 139. Okay. It says Aragorn is 87.
Yeah, because for some reason, because he's, the heir to the throne, he lives longer, and he's part elf.
No, that's true. The elf part. Right. That does change things, I suppose. Because elves are immortal, apparently.
Yep.
Which I think that has dulled a little bit in most... In most fantasy worlds, elves are just very long-lived, but not immortal. They don't live forever. They just live for, like, 500 years.
I've heard that they're 10,000, 25,000 years. Yeah, that's just a thing that they do.
Yeah, Elrond knows all this stuff because he was there. He's been around the entire time. The
first time we took care of this, yeah, I was there, too.
Yeah, I've been every... Like, I remember all this stuff. Believe me, it's a burden. Everyone comes to me and goes, what should I do? I'm like, well, let's see. 10,675 years ago, this is how we handled it. And this other dude I knew cut off his hand, and then now it's back again. I thought
the ring was... Crazy stuff happened. It's like,
I thought the ring...
You can take care of this yourselves.
I thought the ring was lost, but I'm not sure. I guess it's not. Blah, blah, blah. I don't, like... despite all that kind of description and world-building stuff, it still reads pretty quickly. I have a larger respect for Tolkien's language, how he writes, and in the words he loved words, he loved languages, because he invented several, but also just the simple words that he uses in replacement of other words in this book, and they are every single one. Contributes to the overall feeling of this world. And a lot of times, I don't know if it's just because they're so ubiquitous, I don't care. Like, I don't know. I have a particular sticking point against a lot of fantasy fiction and any kind of speculative fiction, and even that's in science fiction, fantasy, horror, any kind of deep genre fiction where people use made up words to, like, because they're a part of this world. Cyberpunk, another huge genre that does it. It's hard. It's a hard thing to do, to have a new word that feels right and feels like it would be a real word, not just made up. And like feel it doesn't. Oh, a made up word for a fictional world that doesn't feel like writing. It feels lived in and feels like a part of that world. And Tolkien does it masterfully.
Well, yeah, because everyone uses these words and you feel like, oh, yeah, they've been using that word forever. Like, I don't know how he gets it in there so organically. It's masterful storytelling, I guess.
I feel like it is all a small piece of this greater whole. And because he understood myth and folklore so well as a scholar, he understood where they functioned. Like, if you read medieval epics and you read Beowulf and you like those, he understood, hey, I'm retrofitting these old ideas and I'm building a world here. He understood their placement. He understood how they worked in the right context. And so he could make it feel right. And despite the fact that some of those songs get really obnoxious, the songs themselves do contribute to this. It contributes to, this is a real place. This is a real place. This has a real history. They like to sing.
And then they have all these songs that they've made up, and it seems like they are real. That everyone seems to know these songs, and that's just the way it is, and it just doesn't seem out of place.
It's the other thing that primarily, like, that's another big thing that of G.R.R. Martin, that of those, all the songs that come up again and again in Game of Thrones. That's the other, like, that's one of the things I go, boom, right there, easy. And they even use, like, so, like, as, like, flagpoles, as markers for plot and for memory and stuff like that. Very, very well crafted, very smartly done. I don't know. I thought I'd have more complaints.
Me too, because I remember the first time I read this, there were a lot of things where I was just like, yeah, you know, whatever. This is really starting to drag on. But reading it now, I just think that's just the way it is. You know, that's just the way he wrote. I can get past that. Maybe I have a better attention span now than I did.
I don't know if my attention span's any better. Maybe I just have a better appreciation for better for good writing and for interesting and for the I think you have we have a greater context for it.
True.
Over the past 20 years, even like fantasy as a genre is never going away. People, there's still multiple authors who write exclusively in fantasy and make a very good living on it. And I think we have a better context for that. We have a better context for the history of this and the short. Like it's we're three generations removed from Tolkien, maybe two, really, depending on how you want to count novel.
Yeah, novel. I count generations. Well, it's not important.
I know it's two or three generations of away from him. Like so, it's still a very new genre to a certain extent. Like I think it's easier to appreciate how novel this was, and still how like. You know, when you're playing video games now or playing if you're playing a role playing if like you're in depth in role playing games and fantasy role playing games, even if those games are purposefully subverting the tropes that Tolkien established, they would never have been established without Tolkien. Like you see them all the time in board games, in video games, in role playing games where oh, the elves in this are different than normal elves.
It's like, oh, these are creepy elves. Or like in the Dragon Age series, the elves in there, they're not respected or anything. They're like people are racist against elves and, you know, make them live outside of cities and that sort of thing. And you're like, whoa, this is weird.
But it's only weird because we are so used to Tolkien elves, these shining, respected, brilliant angels, basically, where... You know, when you see, oh, here, these elves are like the subservient class in this world. That's okay. All right. That's neat. That's an interesting twist on things. Like, it's all there. I feel like we're going to have to probably wait till Return of the King to actually talk about it. But I do want to put a bookmark on it for the racism in Lord of the Rings and how Tolkien writes about fantasy races and how he categorizes them and how he describes them. It's a thing that has always stood out in my mind after I heard about it, and it's kind of impossible to avoid. I don't think Tolkien was a racist, but I think he can't help the environment he was raised in, and he can't help that he was, you know, he was writing from England and he was Eurocentric and all that. But I think we need more evidence, and we'll probably end up just touching on it more largely in our last, the last book, because I think then we'll have all the books to kind of source from in more prescient manner. But, you know, it's even already, it's not light and dark. A lot of times it's white, black and white.
Yeah.
And it's hard not to see it. And it's a thing that is also, like, there was a really smart article written by Saladin Ahmed about... who's a fantasy author himself and now a comic writer, about comparing Martin and Tolkien and the issues of race in a fantasy setting. And, you know, he is a Middle Eastern dude and a brown skinned dude, and he is a huge fantasy fan, but he has to reckon with the fact that a lot of fantasy is like, hey, it's a bunch of white guys, like, and all the dark skinned people are monsters. The worst orcs are the darkest orcs. And you're like, it's not necessarily a good look there, Tolkien.
No, no. But I mean, you know, this is a guy who grew up in the English countryside.
Yeah, exactly.
So
but
I'm not excusing it, but it's understandable, I guess.
And I think we can touch on it more as we go if there's more concerning things. But I think largely we'll see more of it, honestly, in the second and third books as things get more serious and we see like more and more orcs and groups of men, countries of men in this world end up siding with Mordor and Sauron. Also Sauron, and that is the one thing that I don't like about the movies. Like I could care, like so many people complain about Tom Bombadil being excluded, but the eye of Sauron, it wasn't a real eye. It's not a giant eye just hanging out in the sky.
What? Are you sure, Robbie?
It's him sensing things and seeing things through magic. It is not, hey, this giant eye is like a spotlight, like we're in a prison yard. But I don't know. I am so curious what Tolkien himself would think about those movies, because he hated every adaptation that was made while he was alive. So I don't know how he'd feel about those movies. I would be really interested to see how he felt. Would he think that Viggo made a good Aragorn?
I don't know. It's a good question. I would hope so. Seems pretty great.
I mean, Viggo's a good person, and he's still what I picture when I think of Aragorn. Just like Orlando Bloom, I picture as Legolas, and it's all of them. You know, I tried to like force my mind to create a crafted different image of these people. These characters just did not work. I just could not do it. Sean Astin is the best casting, I do want to say.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, Sean Astin does a great job as just like this put upon like servant guy who is just incredibly loyal but very willing to go through anything.
And also, this is the other thing that stood out to me. Having played D&D in my life, this adventuring group that they put together is not that different from any, like, it is full of silliness, and they name, like, this is a like when they find that pony and they name it Bill.
Yeah,
I immediately went like, that's what I would do. Like, and if I'm role playing and I'm playing some adventurer, like there, or at least someone in my party would do. They'd be like, oh, we found a pony, let's name it. And you're like, oh, yep, we are following in his footsteps. Still, we're just gonna name ponies Bill. That poor pony. Does Bill make it out alive, Matt? Please tell me.
I don't remember. I mean, last I heard, or last we saw in this book, they just like, here, go home, Bill.
He ran away. And there was a big tentacle monster, and he ran away in the water.
Well, I mean, in the book, he ran away before that. Like, they're like, just here, go on, Bill.
He lives, Matt. Spoiler alert.
Oh, thank God. Phew.
He makes it back to Hobbiton.
Oh, good.
He's reunited with Sam. So thank God.
Well, thank goodness. I was very worried for a while there.
I'm like, I know what happens to everyone else, but what about Bill? I forget Bill. Don't forget Bill. He's important. He's a very sweet. He's a sweet horse, pony, not really a horse.
Yeah.
What else did you want to bring on that? You got anything in your notes?
That's really it. I can't really think of anything else. I mean, we talked about the one thing I wanted to, that I had a theory, and I proposed it to my wife, and she seemed open to it because she's read the book as well, is that it seems like Fellowship of the Ring is a bit of a analog for growing up, essentially, because you start out your life in the Shire where everything's wonderful all the time, everyone seems to get along, and this is of course idealized for what life is supposed to be like, and then, you know, something happens and you have to move away. Usually you go to school, either to boarding school if you're English, or, you know, college if you're most anywhere else, and it seems like that is going out to the forest where Tom Bombadil finds them, because like, oh, you got in some trouble, but your dad is still there to kind of help you out, or, you know, some other type of, you know, older man is there to help you if you have any type of problems. But then once you get out into the real world, somewhere like Bree, you're constantly chased by horrible things. And if you're lucky, you'll find, someone Aragorn or Gandalf who will basically, they won't take care of you, but they'll help you along and use their knowledge to kind of save you. And then you hope you'll get to somewhere like Rivendell, but then things just go up and down from there, kind of thing. And you'll basically have this group of people you make good friends with, and then you'll go through some crazy stuff with them, but eventually it'll break up and you'll be lucky if you're left with one good friend on your own, kind of thing. So it seems as almost as if like that has how Tolkien saw, you know, a person's life transpiring up to at least we got to the end of Fellowship, which I'm sure, I don't know if this will stick through the end, or if this just ends here and it's just my crazy interpretation.
I mean, Frodo is, and this is the thing that Tolkien did not like invent or anything. It is a smart choice that many, many, many writers do. Is you set your protagonist as an everyman, as a low level person, a low level simple guy who, for some reason, there's some, you know, Harry Potter. It's the same thing. You as this put upon person that for some reason, there's something special about them. And they have to be the one. They have to be the person that saves the day. You know, Frodo is the only one who can carry that ring. And it is, you know, that is, it's similar to the hero's journey. Frodo himself is, and all the hobbits, all of them, not just Frodo, but Frodo, of course, is like he is the hobbit. Except for, you know, he's not literally the hobbit because that's, yeah. that's Bilbo because he is, you know, he is the titular hobbit, but they're simple and they're innocent, naive even. And you talked about how he's like willing to give up the ring to all these people. He's like, I can just give up the ring because they see, you know, they maybe distrust big people at first, but I feel like Frodo in particular is very trusting and very, I don't know, innocent and wants to see the best in people, wants the best in everything.
I mean, yeah, well, like we said, he's trying to give away that ring to anyone who seems like a cool guy.
Yeah, he's like, hey, Gandalf, you take it. Hey, Galadriel, you want it? Hey, Elrond.
Aragorn, you want this
Aragorn,
thing? You got
please.
This?
Hey, you seem like a stand-up fella. But I think that is that growth. That is a growth that is parallel to a person growing up because that's the same kind of journey you go when you grow up. You learn about the world because he's never left the Shire before. He's never crossed the Brandywine, and now he has, and now he's seeing the world for the first time. He's learning how people really are, and he's learning about how this world is a dangerous place and how you can't trust everything. You know, that I think that is the one thing that I do think is worthwhile in all that Tom Bombadil stuff is multiple times he is deceived by some supernatural force that he thinks is nothing. You know, he has a tree, the willow tree, that holds grudges for a very long time, apparently.
Yeah.
And the Barrow-wights, like, he doesn't know what they are. He just knows, hey, this stuff's kind of spooky. And then he almost dies for it multiple times. And it's him, it's like a little kid touching an oven. And you're like, don't touch. You can tell them don't touch the oven, but sometimes they have to do it just to learn.
Uh-huh.
And that's what kind of what Frodo is. And like the ring is carrying this ring is a crash course in life outside of the Shire, because the Shire has largely remained immune from that kind of entropy of the world fading. But
it's because their lives are so simple, obviously.
Yeah, it's, you know, whatever reason you want. It's because the hobbits are so innocuous and have nothing to give that no one has tried to take things from them, because the Shire is way out in the middle of nowhere. No one necessarily cares about it yet, but you know, we see the vision of, you know, Sam sees that vision of the Shire kind of turn into a hellscape, at least his version of a hellscape, of like this industrialization of that. And that, you know, Mordor represents that, you know, it is like Sauron and Mordor are like, hey, war machines and gears and grossness and gross technology, you know. And none of that's a mistake. Tolkien fought in World War One, so he like firsthand experience about the horror of technology when used to fight wars, machine guns, yeah, mustard gas, all that stuff, trench warfare. And Frodo is encountering all this stuff for the first time, and it's opening his eyes. And I don't think it's necessarily intended to be like, hey, coming of age kind of arc, but it certainly is parallel to it, because it is him realizing the world outside of the Shire is not a nice place. There are sanctuaries along the way, and you have friends, people will help you, but there's Nazgul out there, there's Barrow-wights, there's willow trees that will kill you. There's lots of things that will kill
even
you.
Even the trees are out to get you.
Even the trees. Can't even trust the trees. I don't know. This read a lot faster than I expected to, and I liked it a lot more than I expected to. I expected to respect it, but now I respect it and just enjoyed my time. It's just fun. It's just so comforting to be in that world again, to have these familiar characters be with you. You know, you feel like you're in the party with these guys. You feel like you're going on this adventure with Frodo and Gimli and Aragorn, and they're just walking around with you, and you're going into dark dungeons, and you're going into these like tree worlds with the elves, and you're just like, oh, this is a fun adventure.
You can run out your front door and yell, I'm going on an adventure.
Exactly. I'm going on an adventure. That everything, Matt?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure that's all.
Okay. We will be reading the rest of these books, so if you want to get a head start, go ahead and get your two towers on, and we'll get there, you know, whenever we get there. We'll talk about some Ents. It's my favorite.
They're probably the best part of Two Towers.
I love the Ents so much. The Ents are so cool. Love the Ents.
The Ents are the grumpy old men.
Yeah. And they talk so slow. It's all of it so much fun. I think that'll do it. Hey, Matt, what do you want to plug?
I really got nothing. Nothing at all.
Nothing. Not even as, let's see, there is a particular podcast you're a part of and also a particular Instagram page that has lots of kittens on it.
Oh, I suppose I can plug the Kitten Interns page, KITT Interns on Instagram, where there are lots of cute kittens that could use a little home. So, you know, if you need a kitten, that's the place to go.
Or your local animal shelter.
That works too. Just, you know, get all the kittens you can.
Adopt, don't shop. As they say. Lots of animals need your help. And they'll love you for their entire lives for you helping them. Now we just need some Sarah McLachlan
singing. Yes, exactly. That's what we need on this podcast is Sarah McLachlan.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Matt, for joining me.
Of course. Anytime. Especially for good books like this.
Thanks again to Matt for joining me. You can find me on Twitter at Robbie Dorman, and the show's website is SerialFanaticist.com. You can follow our Facebook page at Facebook.com/SerialFanaticist. If you like the show, please give us a 5-star review on iTunes or whatever podcatcher you use. Tell your friends. Subscribe. You know the drill. You listen to podcasts. It helps. I appreciate it. Until next time, thanks for being a fan.